the theme for the afternoon talk is two levels of life. So with the talk with you this afternoon, I would speak about one level and then refer to the other. And the first level we might describe as the everyday level that we are terribly again familiar with. And then a shift, movement to a deeper level, which we are in urgent need to give much more care and time and attention to. If we take with regard to the first level, here's the level of our life unfolding itself from day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year. We experience the passage of time flowing by. Come in. There's room all around the place. No problem. Just squeeze in. If anyone is into letting go, one could always offer a cushion. Ah, nice. I know it's a Hinayana tradition, but nevertheless. Wicked. All right? Okay, you're good. So the theme for the afternoon talk, two levels. One is the everyday level. The everyday level carries with it, as a central feature of it, our everyday story. This is the everyday level. It says, I am passing through this life. This is who I am. We give a description of ourselves. We say, I am so and so. I was born in so and so. I've reached this age, and this is what I have done with my life. And this is what I haven't done with my life, and I should have done with my life. So this is the everyday human story that goes on. And then we tell it to other people, and they say, I know just how you feel, it's the same for me. So we can all share in our misery together. It's very comforting. So we have our ups and downs as we make the journey through our day-to-day life. We also need in that to give that more care and attention, still everyday level for a moment. And in giving something more care and attention, it means that we can apply one precious quality that we have, and that is to be conscious. The factor that makes us human, that humanizes us, which is expresses our humanness, is our remarkable ability to be conscious. Tragically, we're foolish. We rarely exercise this. And the exercising of what a retreat is about, it's the exercising of consciousness. It is to bring this precious and beautiful element, this distinguishing element of our species, on to what matters. And in its application of being conscious, doors will open up. And that requirement, that priority, is to look and to see, what do I really need to be conscious of, conscious about? And that requires interest. It requires love. It requires attention. It requires intention, commitment. And when that begins to come out of the being, out of our inner life, then we then have the application of being conscious, to be a conscious human being. There's no alternative. There's no nothing other than it's the priority. Then we ask, well, what do I wish to be conscious of? What matters? And sometimes we grasp on to particulars, whatever it might be. In this phenomenal world, we will pick out certain things or people, and those things and people will stand out for us. We get the idea in this phenomenal world as human beings that the selection, what I pick out, what my attention lands upon, really does matter, and I make it something special. I hold on to it, him, her. I get the idea, or some will have the idea, living in the real world is the pursuit of goods. Living in the real world is through gathering and accumulation. Living in the real world is having more of anything. And I have this idea, this impression. I look around me and I look at other people and I think, wow, he or she or they are so successful. And my idea is because they have got this. They've got a nice house, they've got a nice job, but they've got money, they've got kids, they've got a nice relationship, they've got a nice neighbour, they've got a nice dog. Anything. So the movement of the attention is so easy, building this up. And it's a message which we have been sold, literally sold this message, sold. And because it's been sold to us, we are the new slaves. We are a slave to this orthodoxy of owning, having, pursuing and getting. And once one begins to question that and ask, do I want to live as a slave? Because a slave is always in stress. A slave always feels pressure. A slave always feels trapped. A slave always feels boxed in. So we get boxed in with the job, boxed in with the mortgage, boxed in with the debts, boxed in with the unhappiness, boxed in with the worries. This is slavery. Slavery is never ended. And we are told that in this slavery, it's not slavery, it's freedom. We've been sold such a mythology that this is freedom. If this is freedom, God help us. It's a nightmare. And the consequence of this, the impact of this on the inner life, is stress, anger, blame, guilt, worry and anxiety. And then this is called living in the real world. It's a disaster area. If this is the real world, there's no escape. If this is the real world, there's no release. There's no liberation. There's no enlightenment. So it's an extraordinary thing for a human being who says to herself, says to himself, I do not want to live anymore as a slave. I don't want to be trapped in this way of living like this. I want to find something authentic which brings love and joy and happiness and great release. And that really is going to challenge us and challenge all the indoctrination that has been and continues to be imposed upon us. And one has to be in protest against it. The tragedy is that somehow or other, in the distortion of the mind, what slavery we call freedom, we've turned it round the other way, and we've been sold all of this. So let me say, okay, I want to look at what's the process, what is going on with me, what do I need to be aware of that I need to question, to need to look at, and that's going to and continues to challenge all of us. But it's a worthwhile exploration. It's worthwhile looking into life and learning to see things as they are. Because it's seeing things clearly that brings out of us great liberation and great love. Sometimes, as you will see in the meditations here, sometimes it's just on the contact. Just on contact. What do we do when we have an impression? You look around. On any retreat, say a retreat here, there's 100 people. There will always be, always was, and no doubt always will be, a few eccentric people on a retreat. It goes with it. And we can look at the eccentric people. Some might be climbing trees and having earphones on, or playing football, or smoking a cigarette under the bushes. I don't know what having conversations about how the basketball team lost in Russia. All these things might be going on there. And so easy. One sees this, there's an impression. Ah, I see this going on, or I smell this, the smoke, or I hear this, which is going on. And what we make of it tells us not very much about what we're seeing and hearing. It tells us something about who we are. We think our view of the eccentrics, we think our view of them is telling us, when the view arises, about the people we're looking at. Oh, she's like this, and he's like this, and they are like this, etc. It's telling us little or nothing. But it is telling us something about ourselves. About ourselves. And so sometimes, as one person said in the group today, in the Vipassana world, come in, find a place, or levitate above people, whatever it is. That sometimes we have a term sometimes used in the Vipassana, it's called VV, and it's got nothing to do with victory, I can tell you. It's Vipassana villain. You know what a villain is? It's been translated into Hebrew?
Rasha.
Eh? Rasha. Not Russia, Russia, okay, all right, okay. Could be confusing. I used to be the villain, but anyway. So, the perception, lots of different people. And some poor sod, some poor devil, gets selected out, picked out. We don't know why, as being a Vipassana
Rasha.
We're passing our villain, our VV. And whatever that person does, there's something wrong with it. Him or her. They eat too quickly. They walk too quickly. They talk to other people. They're only sitting still to impress other people. Whatever it might be. They leave their shoes facing opposite directions. Whatever, they snore at night, and they take up far too much time with the teachers. And in the movement of the inner life, this poor innocent person just come here to do their practice. Remember, you could be talking about you. Just remember, don't you know, whatever. So this person is just doing their practice and has no idea that 10% of the population around here is engaged in a hate campaign. You never know, etc. And so and all of that becomes the interpretation. It becomes, this is how I see this person, therefore this is how the person is. This is this kind of person. And it's based a minimal impression. It's a great act of consciousness, a great act of responsibility in life, to take off the image of the person, to release the person to being who they are, and to take that movement onto back to where it came from, and to start here And this is the great act of responsibility. There's no greater act in life. It's the great movement of life to shift from him or her and take that responsibility and to take it back and say, this is where it starts and this is where it finishes. Otherwise, we live our life utterly dependent on other people. And it's not really other people. We live our life dependent on the interpretation of other people. Whoa! Slavery. Again. A slave to the idea of somebody else. We are so used to it as human beings, as a species, as a group, as a collective, that all the identities, as Rakafet was speaking to us yesterday evening, we impress it so strongly, this view, that we think we're in reality. We believe we're in reality. We persuade others we're in the reality. Reality is in another level. It's not in this area. Let's take situation. Not unusual. Somebody is very angry with us. It can manifest in a whole countless numbers of ways. Somebody's just angry towards us. And when that anger is being directed towards us, it may show itself in the hard word. Hard words. It may show itself in coldness and detachment and withdrawal. But we sense, we pick up the anger there. There are angry people in the world. It's not a moralistic judgment, it's a fact. There are angry people in the world. The difficulty is, when we are on the receiving end of the anger from another person, whoever she human, what's our response? What is the skillful way to handle it well? What typically happens to us? Sometimes we just replicate, we duplicate, we do the same thing as the other person. You're angry with me? Right. I'm really pissed off with you. So there's a few things I've been wanting to say to you for a long time. It's called verbal diarrhea. And we just drop it on them. We're no different. We're trapped in the story. Sometimes our response is, you treat me unkindly, you're cold to me, you won't talk to me, right, bugger off, I'm not going to talk to you, don't bother to email me, text me, ring me, because as far as I'm concerned, you're dead. A very nice way to respond. We just repeat, we become a clone of the person. And both justifying the position. Oh, we just get defensive. I don't know if you've noticed. If we are under attack, the problem is anger, there's negativity, there's blame. Sometimes, no matter what we say, it sounds defensive. It could be true, but it comes across defensive. So we've got a problem. If we say anything back, we sound angry. If we say anything to explain, we sound defensive. And if we shut up, we're just detached. We're cold. We're cut off. But one of these three are easily, or all of them, are patterns that we're familiar with. Perhaps we have to listen deeper than the anger, than the blame. Perhaps we've got to really be conscious. Perhaps we've got to find the empowerment within ourselves, say, well, what really is going on for this person? essentially, what is the need that's not being met? What is it that the person is asking for? And the only way this person is asking for something is through anger. We've got to get close to the fire. We've got to learn to take the heat of negativity and reactivity. Personally, socially, politically, internationally. It's all the same story. And really listen, what is the need that's coming from this person? What are they asking for us, from us? What can I say that will help to address that need? And to really listen. That doesn't guarantee, obviously, there will be a valuable and worthwhile response. But we are conscious. We are attentive. We are listening. We are totally dedicated to it. And there's a power to it. It may be the person still feels upset, still withdraws, still keeps a distance. The old tendency might start to come back in. Blame. Judgment. It's impossible. Nothing works. This person is hopeless. This person is a mistake in the species or something. The views may still arise. And we're still asking ourselves, can I stay conscious as the act of human responsibility to be available, accessible, and listen? And never, whoever, close the door. If you're on this retreat, and any of what's said matters to you, then there will always, there's 100 people, will be a few people who you know you have closed the door to. And when you close the door to another, you close off something inside yourself. You are then your own worst enemy. Sometimes people have to take a very deep, honest, inner look and ask themselves, is there anybody in my life that I have closed off to? Because if you have, you've closed off love inside of yourself. And the price of that's heavy. No matter who it is, no matter what was done, no matter what. And that is an extraordinary challenge to us. In the engagement, still at the relative, everyday, conventional here. In our living and relating and connecting and being with each other. There's the contact, as I mentioned, and the impressions which arise. And some of these troublesome mind states, like the Buddha said when he was under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, sitting through the middle of the night. We are also familiar with this as well. The demons arise. Meaning sometimes it seems like there are kind of movements in our inner life, forces in our inner life, which just grab a hold of us, making our own life difficult and making other lives difficult. And again, it's a challenge. And sometimes, inside of ourself, we don't have the answer. This lovely mythology, Truth is Within You, which does the New Age rounds again and again and again, frankly, sometimes it isn't. It's a lovely idea. And we can sit and close our eyes and say, Truth, please, for God's sake, pop up. Because I believe the New Age Wallers, etc. And sometimes we say, well, there's no truth in me, I'm useless. So it must have passed me by, it must have landed somewhere else, and then maybe somebody else has got it. Maybe one of those four people sitting on the toilet up here has got it, the throne, or whatever, or perhaps somebody in India has got it, or even in Jerusalem, that would be a miracle. And excuse me, I'm sorry about that. or whatever. It's a joke.
America.
It's a joke. America, even where exactly in America, that would really something. Etc. All right. Nobody has truth. Nobody's got it. No book has got it, no tradition's got it, no religion's got it, no philosophy's got it, no science has got it, nobody's got it. Whew, thank goodness for that. Can you imagine the pressure if somebody had got it? Eh? God, blimey, it's dreadful. Someone's got it, nobody else has got it, we'd all be running around this person, etc. Truth is something else. It's not a human possession. This is when we start shifting levels, the beginning of the shift of the level. Truth is not something. We are mad about something, or we are mad about someone, or we are mad about some idea. We keep Buddhist language, give it selfness, thingness, isness. We pull it out of existence, or we pull him or her out, or we make it something, and then we can invest, which is a nice word for infect, somebody with truth. Oh, they've got truth. Truth is the moment of transformation. It's the moment that we're touched, is the moment of waking up. So I say sometimes it emerges just like that. And it's not that you've got it, or I have got it, or we, or someone has got it. But sometimes we say, I can't see what this situation. I can't get to the truth of the matter. I can't get some insights into this. And we may need, and we must keep the doors open to the wise counsel of others. It's not that he or she or they or we have got the truth, got that which wakes us up, got that which releases us from slavery. It's not that they or we have got it, but it can happen, and it does happen, that in the interaction, in the dialogue, in the sharing, in the discourse, the clarity comes, and therefore the truth has come. We don't quite understand how it comes or where it comes from, but sometimes it just emerges out of the situation, out of the meditation, out of the contact with the nature, out of the reading, out of the reflection, out of the listening to each other with interest and attention, and out of the event. Truth comes, and it changes us. It wakes us up. It opens up our heart. It makes us conscious. It does something. And nobody's got it. It's not an ownership. And it's a delusion of Buddhism. And it's a delusion of religion and philosophy to think somebody has got it. Because once they've got it, they want to sell it. Once they got it, they want to get others to believe it. Once they've got it, they want to organize it. So we're interested in truth. We're interested in that which enters into the dialogue of life, of human life. And to see what comes that way, wow, contributes a sense of waking up, to being conscious, to discovery. And then something is shifting from this everyday level of quiet life, unsettled life, happy life, unhappy life, life with pleasure in it, life with pain in it, life with struggle in it, life which is easygoing, and just moving along, or let me say, is that it? Is that the sum total of our life? We enter into this world, we move along with it, and then life comes along and says, right, basketambogya, finish, over. You're in, you've had your trip in life, now you're out. Is that it? Can't we as human beings look deeper than all of that? Have a sense of what truth is, what reality is? Can't be in our stories and in our images and in all that we project onto other people. In the Dharma, it has at the deeper level, it has a very profound interest. I'll try to communicate it. A very profound interest in what we call causation. Does everybody understand this Hebrew word? Causation. Causes, effects, movement, conditions, interactivity of events. General word, causation. Universal causation. All that which brings about an event. So if we take our being here together, numerous causes and conditions have made it possible for us to be here this afternoon. From our own intentions, and the cooperation of others, and the time, and the place, and the support, and vehicles, and multiple conditions, this is called causation. Multiple conditions enable us to be here right now. This is called causation. When there is some area of problematic life, the interest and the inquiry into causation matters a great deal. And there are four primary areas to look at. Four primary areas. One of them, we're talking about problematic life here, when there's some problem with our life. One of them, and it's not that making one more important than the other, one of them is what's going on inside. What does one want? Any kind of problem in life, somewhere in the problem, acknowledged or not recognized, but somewhere in it there will be some expression of wanting. Try and think of a problem without a wanting in it. Not a human being can do it. Name a problem. Look at it and there will be some wanting in it. Maybe wanting it to be over with. Maybe wanting the other person to be over with. Maybe wanting the life to be over with. Maybe wanting more. Maybe wanting less. Maybe wanting it to improve. Maybe wanting it to change. Maybe wanting it to keep it as it is. Maybe wanting to get it back. Maybe wanting it to start. Maybe wanting it to continue. Maybe wanting it to finish. I think I'm running out of the wantings here. You get the picture. All right. Wanting in the fantasy. Wanting in the memory. Wanting in the present moment. Wanting in the future. Wanting, 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 wanting. So one of the conditions for problematic life is the wanting. A second condition for problematic life is the history which we have not given attention to. The history, our history, or the history in a relationship with another, where there has been in it a blind spot. The Buddha uses this term, avidya, Vidya means knowing, seeing. Avidya, not seeing, not knowing, not realizing. And then in the passage of time, through not seeing and not knowing, not realizing, then a crisis arises. Things were not taken notice of. One was not conscious in the past, and through not being conscious in the past, one has a crisis today. Crises don't arise out of the blue. They don't just come as some horrible event which one's the victim of. It comes out of the circumstances of what was not seen and not recognized. Sometimes we need to engage in some wise reflection. Sometimes in these kind of traditions, there's much too much emphasis on the here and now. The here and now has become the sacred cow. And if the Buddha was to hear all this talk about the here and now, and be here and now, and the power of now, he'd think, what the hell's going on? He'd feel completely bemused with it. There's not a statement in 5,000 talks of be here and now. That's not in there. So the looking and the power of reflection means at times you and I need to forget the present moment. It's not a sacred cow. It's just the moment. There. And to leave the here and now, to engage in some reflection. What was happening in the causes and conditions in the field of time that has left me a complete mess? What happened? What did I ignore? What did I neglect? What did I suppress? What is it I wasn't conscious of? Because life can be, as some of us know, through ignoring, suddenly there's a huge volcanic eruption in the life. Where the hell did that come from? It came from not looking at what the process of one's life, what was going on with it. And then we feel we're hopeless, we can't handle anything. To be conscious is in our greatest interest. One is intention, desire, the wanting to look. Second, what are the conditions that contribute to really look into those conditions that bring that about? What needs to be changed? A third is, we could say, around time and place. When things happen to us, they happen in the time and place. They happen in relationship, say, to a certain role or identity that we have. And we put the time, the place, the roles, the identities that we have, and all of that also become conditions for an issue to arise. And the fourth is just, how to say, multiple knowns and unknowns that we poor human beings can never get a handle on. Understand? I say, okay, I can look at the wanting, yes. I'm going to say, oh yeah, there are blind spots, you know, I can look at those and say, well, this leads to this, etc. I can see, oh, it's time bound up with time and space and position and identity and gender and all these other issues there. And sometimes there are just so many conditions we just can't, there. Nagarjuna, who's I regard as the great commentator on the Buddha's teachings, he comes out with a very strong statement. He said, there are these four conditions, and there is no fifth. Whoa, nice one. So there is no point in being angry with God, as some of you like to be, because G-O-D is not considered. I know. There's no point in saying, oh, it's just fate. what the hell is fate, etc. Or it's just by chance. It just happened. Nothing ever just happened. Nothing comes out of the blue, no matter what Charles Darwin tells you. Don't take any notice. We say it's sort of just by chance because he didn't look deeply enough. Things arise because the conditions are there for them to arise. And it's the great task of men and women living on this earth to live a really conscious life and not fall into the error of pinpointing responsibility to an abstraction called God, fate, life, chance. This is when we are too lazy to look. We can be conscious, we can look. And that very looking begins to make the shift. It's a beautiful, precious shift from a life trapped in stories to a deeper and more profound seeing, which, when truth enters into the deeper level, it's liberating. It's freeing us up. We're coming out of slavery. It would be an ego trip if you felt you came out of slavery. Don't buy the story that you came out of slavery. You're in it. Still wandering around in the wilderness. You have to question these. It gives a false picture. It's just that the forms of slavery have changed. The pharaohs are in the private and public sector. The corporate world, the manipulators of government, from government, these are the pharaohs. Things haven't changed. The unhappiness is a confirmation of it. The stress is a confirmation of it. The conflict and the anger and the blame is a confirmation of the slavery. The dependency, the debts, the crises that go on in people's lives. It's still slavery. And it's a great task. And if it means wandering around in the wilderness, better. With all the uncertainty and the insecurity, better to stay with that and find one's way out than to continue to live under the shadow of the pharaohs from without and the pharaohs from within. Better. That's an enormous challenge for all of us. It's an enormous undertaking. But it's that kind of acknowledging the levels, as I mentioned, without going on too long about it. It's acknowledging those levels that take place and the difficulties of human discourse. The willingness, to repeat a little bit, of really being conscious, following a process that's going on, engaging in this wonderful resource of some reflection. What do we need to be clear about here? What will sustain the love? What will keep that sense of intimacy so alive and it's so beautiful and profound, it's not dependent on another person's behavior? It's not dependent on my thought. I mean, we get a sense of that. We are genuinely close to the promised land, in the real, authentic sense, not a mythological sense. The story is a reminder. It's a here and now story. It's a realization that took place, which applies to all generations of people. Don't think of it as the past. It's a mistake. It's a present engagement. That's the power of the story. And sometimes we have a taste. Sometimes there's a natural, spontaneous sense of the freedom of the being. a natural sense of love emerging out of the cells of our life. And it's got nothing to do with people, how people are. It's not got that dependency on that. And same with the joy and the happiness. It's got nothing to do with having and owning and getting. It just comes of itself, by itself. Because it's the manifestation of what freedom is. So we look and we cognize and we give attention to the ordinary and the everyday, these ups and downs of life. Why not? Of course we should. But we're not going to settle for that. We're interested in the promised land. We're interested in great liberation. We're interested, deeply interested in the ending of all slavery of the mind. And that's precious. Let's have a quiet minute or two, shall we?